Today's edition of the Capital Daily Podcast is brought to you by Moshqua Art and Soap Studio. To see the latest release of original large and small pieces, head to moshqua.com. Introducing the Capital Daily's weekly photo challenge. Each week, our team will post the weekly photo theme in Monday's Capital Daily newsletter, as well as announcing it right here on the podcast, with winners receiving gift cards to local Victoria businesses around town. This week's theme is nighttime photography. To find out how you can enter, check out Monday's Capital Daily newsletter. Hi, I'm Ben Waterworth, and welcome to the Capital Daily Podcast for Tuesday, November 3rd, 2020. Today on the podcast,
you can see low voter turnout as a bad thing, or you can see it as a bunch of people who, you know, were kind of fine with how everyone was doing and didn't want to go out that day.
We chat with Capital Daily editor Tristan Hopper about the 2020 BC election results and break down just exactly what the newly released data shows, as well as previewing today's US election and what the results may mean for both BC and Vancouver Island. Elections are seemingly on the mind of everyone right now, with results and data still flowing in from last week's BC election, as well as the US today going to the polls to either re-elect Donald Trump or elect former Vice President Joe Biden as president. On the weekend, the Capital Daily published a series of data from last week's BC election with a variety of interesting facts coming to light. There is also plenty of ramifications to come from the US election for BC and just what either leader may mean for this part of Canada. To discuss both elections, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the Capital Daily Podcast the editor of the Capital Daily, Mr. Tristan Hopper. Tristan, thanks once again for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, on the weekend, we published a series of data from the BC election. Can you give us a bit of a brief on what some of the main findings were in these data that we released?
So when we first came out, so the day after the election, we knew that the NDP had won a whole bunch of ridings and were forming government, but we didn't have the actual specific numbers because you still had a bunch of mail-in votes to count. So we kind of have all of those now. So a week afterwards, we wanted to just sort of do a recap of specifically what each race looked like. And then we also got our data analyst, Snehana Verona, to look into some of the more peripheral things related to the election. So voter turnout, fundraising, so how many funds that each party had to go with, election advertising spending, all those types of things. Now you can track Google searches. So there was a few web things we could sort of check because, of course, this was an election that played out mostly online. Anyway, we looked into all those to get a more comprehensive picture. So the NDP still won. I mean, we didn't discover anything particularly new. But yeah, there's a few things that stood out about why this election was unique and why they won it so well. I think we have a better answer for that.
One thing you mentioned there, voter turnout, significantly down this year, 52.4%. It was at 61.2% back in 2017 and 57.1% in 2013. Is this down to the pandemic, Tristan, or is there more to why it was so down?
Could be. I mean, that's a lot to go down 10%. And I do have I have some colleagues in the media who are of the opinion that we should have forced voting. You should get a tax or a fine if you don't vote. But I'm not sure because sometimes it is an active decision not to vote. And that sometimes affects elections. So actually, when I look at the reduced voter turnout, which it could have been because of the pandemic, or sometimes it can be because of sentiments with the candidates on offer. So I'm thinking you may have gotten a strengthened NDP lead in some areas just because BC Liberal voters didn't bother showing up. So maybe, imagine you have a voter maybe in a swing riding like Parksville-Qualicum, who normally vote BC Liberal. They would never vote at BC NDP, ever in their life. But they didn't feel inspired by Andrew Wilkinson or the pitch put together by the Liberals. So they just sit that election out. So you could have had a strengthened NDP lead just because NDP voters loved John Horgan, but all the other parties weren't too pleased with the results. So they just kind of sit it out. So that's actually what happened in the US in 2016. So it wasn't that Donald Trump got a bunch of extra votes. He actually got fewer votes than Mitt Romney had when Mitt Romney had lost to Barack Obama in 2012, but that nobody turned out to vote for Hillary Clinton. So thus, he was able to win. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, but he was able to win the Electoral College because those votes for Clinton went there. And also, sometimes low voter turnout, sometimes it's indicative of something very bad, like in Nunavut, where they have a completely different form of parliament. It's consensus government. They don't have party politics. They actually have a system where, because there's no party politics, I think every decision has to be made with like unanimous approval of the legislature. It's, you know, it's a difficult way to run things. Often they'll have elections where they don't have more than one candidate. It's just by acclamation. So you'll have incredibly low voter turnout because you're thinking, why bother showing up? I mean, there's just one candidate. There's no one running against them, blah, 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 blah. So you could see that as a bad thing. Low voter turnout is low because there are literally no options and you just have to rubber stamp who's available. It's almost like an East German election. But it can also be a sign that things are going well. I think if you have low voter turnout, sometimes it's just because people are generally satisfied with things, the way things are going. There's not a lot of difference between the two major parties, which I definitely think was true this time. It's not like the BC Liberals were putting together a dramatically different vision than what the BC NDP were putting out. So I think, yeah, you can see low voter turnout as a bad thing, or you can see it as a bunch of people who, you know, were kind of fine with how everyone was doing and, you know, didn't want to go out that day.
Has the idea of compulsory voting been discussed much either in BC or Canada? I obviously come from a country, one of the very few countries in the world where it is compulsory voting in Australia. Mm-hmm. So that's all I'm very much used to. But, I mean, has it an idea that is thrown out every now and then that this should be the case here in this part of the world as well?
I've only heard it from Andrew Coyne, who's a columnist for Maclean's and Post Media, and I don't know where he is right now. So I don't know if he was actually riding some wave of we should force people to vote, or this is just some crazy thing that Andrew Coyne hasn't brought up. But you're right. Yeah, Australia is the there's always some country you bring up obnoxiously for your particular policy points. So like, hey, we should run schools like Finland. We should run drug policy like Portugal. So yeah, Australia was, when I was talking to some election nerd, it's like, we should force people to vote because blah, 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 Australia. I try not to have opinions about electoral systems, but I'm not so sure. I think I was in the Andrew Coyne camp of forcing people to vote. But then a few elections went by where I kind of liked the fact that I had the option not to vote, and that that is a form of voting, to just not show up. I mean, that's kind of a sign to parties when, you know, when you can have an election result in which you lost simply because people who normally supported you didn't show up. I mean, that's a signal to politicians as much as a vote against you in some cases.
And for the most part, too, I will say, if you don't vote in Australia, it's not like you're in jail. I mean, you generally just get a bit of a fine if they catch you. And I've known plenty of people who have spent a large portion of their life not voting and never been caught. So, yeah.
Yeah, because I can imagine if you really don't want to vote, like if I really hate all the options on the table, and if I'm forced to vote, I'm just going to show up and write in Elvis,
yes,
or something.
Yes, the donkey vote is a common thing in Australia.
Vote for a donkey?
Yeah, well, they call it the donkey vote if it's a middle one, but no, there's often a donkey in control anyway. But no, the fun fact is that generally if you put down on a piece of paper Elvis, your vote will still go to whoever's got the majority of votes anyway. So kind of you're wasting your vote by not having your voice being heard, and you're still technically voting for someone anyway. So right. There's kind of...
I have spoiled my ballot, but I've never... Yeah,
you've
I've
never quite gone for the Elvis vote.
Well, yeah, I was leaving Alberta. It was an election happening, so I was leaving Alberta like the next month. So I'm like, I shouldn't pick the government here, a place I'm not going to live in. But I wanted to demonstrate voting to my toddler.
Right.
So I got the ballot and spoiled it.
Okay. Oh, that's educational. That's a way of doing it there. I mean, with the voter turnout, though, I mean, unsurprisingly, a huge increase, of course, on mail-in ballots. I mean, 493,000 extra mail-in ballots compared to the last election. It's mentioned in the article that political scientists might ponder for years the effect that this has on final results. I mean, what's your view on this, Tristan? Do you think that mail-in ballots have a genuine effect? I mean, as it's put in the article, do voters potentially think differently voting in their living room than going to a high school gymnasium?
So one trend we're seeing in all these, there's been quite a few pandemic elections. There was one in New Zealand. There was one in Saskatchewan just the day after BC. There was a by-election in Toronto. And the one thing we're finding is that when people vote in the midst of a pandemic, they seem to be, there's always an incumbent advantage. You just pick who's ever in charge. That is like particularly strong during a pandemic, whoever, you don't want to switch up the governance. Sort of a similar thing you see in wartime. So the UK was kind of an exception, but usually in a democracy, you just kind of, we're just going to stick with Franklin Roosevelt. He seems to be doing a good job. So sort of a similar result, but I think maybe, I mean, they're very different circumstances. I mean, going to vote, I mean, you got to put pants on, you got to stand, you're standing with the rest of your neighborhood, you're looking around, you're trying to be respectable. And then what I like about voting at a gymnasium is it's an area completely kept free. There's no political advertising. It's a very nonpartisan space. It's kind of got a bit of ceremony to it, so you feel I'm exercising my right. That's obviously a different situation than I'm just in my pajamas, opening the mail, you know, I'm drunk, I don't, you know, underwear, whatever. I mean, they're different circumstances. So I don't know how many voters are kind of in the air and make their decision right at the end. But, you know, when you look at psychological studies, those are two very different environments and it's two very different people sort of marking that ballot. So maybe if we have enough more pandemic elections and we can start weighing the different tallies between mail-in and vote in person, it could be different. You know, maybe you're more enthralled by your like worst sensibilities. And I'm not saying this applied. I don't think people vote in NDP because they're bad people or whatever. But when you think about, there was a lot of like votes to reference the US election a lot. Again, I think a lot of Trump voters have been very open that they're voting against some. They're like, they can't tell me what to do. I'm voting Trump, goddammit. You know, just kind of this secret act of rebellion. That's probably easier in your living room than at a public voting place.
One thing too, in the article, the money spent by each of the parties, NDP in particular, looking like they had a lot of cash going into this election. The last election in 2017, they spent $4.5 million. This election, nearly $8 million. And while the BC Liberals had $5.7 last election, $6.26, so not as big of an increase. I mean, is this a surprise? I mean, the NDP just do a lot better in fundraising over the last few years. Does that happen when you're in government? You've got that ability to do that. I mean, kind of what do you think happened there? And did this play a significant part in this election?
It helps when you're going into an election in which I think it's fair to say that both opponents, because the NDP called the election, NDP Premier and NDP leader John Horgan called the election, so they had much more notice than everybody else. So that's helpful because they've got all the materials and stuff that's all lined up. And I think the numbers. So the numbers you were citing there, it wasn't quite election spending. So we don't have that yet. I think Elections BC is going to be releasing that in the next months. We're going to get the exact figures. But what we could get was what within the coffers on the day of the election being called. So the NDP had about give or take $8 million versus the BC Liberals, $5 million. And if you look at prior elections, the BC Liberals outspent the NDP in basically every election of the last 20 years. So I think given the numbers we can see, it looks like not only did the NDP likely have more money than both of its opponents combined, but this was probably the election in which they had the most money ever. And part of that is just the incumbent advantage. I do know the BC Liberals, after losing government, they lost a whole pile of fundraising. Huge swaths of people who normally gave lots of money to the BC Liberals are like, well, I'm not going to give it to some opposition party without a leader, or maybe they don't like Andrew Wilkinson or whatever. So if they lost a bunch of funding, I think it stands to reason that, if you're in government, you're going to start getting a bunch more campaign donations. So, yeah, a much richer NDP than we're used to in the last election.
In terms of some of the online data that was released in the article as well, it was interesting to see the Google searches and Facebook ad spending. Clearly, the more and more elections we have in this highly digital world, this becomes more and more important, of course. But the Google search data, which shows high amount of searches for the NDP, and then Sonia Firstenau and the Greens kind of second, which didn't ultimately overall kind of reflect in the voting numbers. Is it surprising to kind of see a lot of people were out there searching for the Greens and that, or does that just come down to, say, the Liberals' general age bracket that maybe they're not using the internet as much as, say, somebody who votes for Greens would be?
That's a tricky one. So we did include it, and it was interesting to see that, with one exception, if you look at the BC Google search data for who's typing in BC NDP versus BC Liberal, BC NDP was always much higher than both of the other parties. But again, that's not always a good thing, because you also look up something if you don't know anything about it. So it could be an example of everybody's already got their opinion in about the BC Liberals and they want to see the BC NDP. Or it can be really bad if just no one's actually heard of you. So I think you did see spikes, I think, after the debates, spikes of people searching the BC Greens simply because they had no idea who Sonia Firstenit was or what the BC Greens platform was. So it could be a good sign. You sort of see her at the debate and think, oh, she's not that bad. I'll go check out their platform and maybe this will affect our vote. So I think there's interesting details you can read from that. But yeah, it's definitely not a clear line from you're getting more Google searches, thus you're going to win. But it can show curiosity, which I suppose is good or bad. I mean, if you screwed up, if John Horgan just came out in a bathrobe and started spouting out racial slurs or something, you'd probably have a bunch of spikes for BC NDP as well.
That would be a very interesting day, should that happen, I can imagine. Shall we see that? But when we had you on a week ago, Tristan, to discuss the initial results, of course, between then and now, Andrew Wilkinson has stepped down as the BC Liberals leader. Two-part question, was that a surprise? And second part, who are the candidates to replace him?
Oh, geez, this is, I have no, not really a surprise. Yeah, when you lose an election worse than basically anyone in recent memory, you're generally expected to step down. And I have no idea who's going to replace him. Absolutely no clue. This is probably going to be, you know, it's probably going to be one of those leadership elections where just everyone runs. There's like 20 at the outset and it slowly gets winnowed down. I'm thinking of like the federal conservative race just after Stephen Harper left. So we'll see. But I'm afraid I don't have any sort of names in reserve, things I've heard any talking about. But definitely probably not anybody from the island, because as we did show from this this chart, the BC Liberals in Vancouver Island are now the third place party. It's, you know, these are basically all NDP safe seats, with the exception of Firstenit and Adam Olson. And then you have Greens in a pretty strong second, and then BC Liberals way back. So we actually have a graph in there which tracks how Vancouver Island ridings have voted since 1996. And that's been years in the making. So you had, obviously, in the 2000 sweep, the 2001 sweep, almost all the ridings went Liberal. And then every year since then, you've seen winnowing support until there's basically no BC Liberal presence left on the island.
How far are we away from the election being officially called? When are we expecting all the results to be finalized? Is it still a couple of weeks away like they initially predicted?
They said November 12th. So November 12th is when we counted absolutely every mail-in ballot. So I don't think things are going to change too much. We'll just have, you know, one percentage point either way. But things are so strong here on Vancouver Island. Like the races were basically all the drama of this election and all the swings occurred on the mainland. That's who decided who the government was. Because here, I guess what surprised me was how strong each of these victories were. So it was pretty common that an NDP candidate would walk away with 45 to 50% of the vote. And that's just an explosively huge lead. That is considered a safe seat.
If you want to read the full data, of course, on this capitaldaily.ca to read that article. Moving to the US election now, happening today, of course, Tristan. Now, we're not American, but it's still, of course, something significant for us to keep an eye on, given it's just kind of down the road a little bit for a lot of us listening today. I mean, how important is it, do you think, for particularly people near the border on the island or, you know, on the mainland to watch it closely and kind of see how this plays out and how it may impact BC and the island?
I don't know how much it actually will impact BC. I was trying to think of, like, you know, direct effects it's going to have on us either way. So what federal policies that either candidate would introduce that might affect us. And I thought economically we're kind of screwed either way. Either, you know, Biden gets in and he doesn't buy our resources because environmentalism, or Trump gets in and he doesn't buy them because nationalism. But I will say that when Trump won in 2016, I was working for the National Post, and I predicted that the reaction could very well be capital flight from the U.S. He would be such an unstable force that you would see basically investment dropping off, similar to what happened in Quebec in the 1970s with the Parle des Québécois. You just said, you know, headquarters leaving, like the exact opposite of that happened. And right before COVID hit, the U.S. economy was just an utter juggernaut. So purely from that perspective, and, you know, I don't know if it's going to drop off if Biden wins or what. But purely from that perspective, we're very closely tied to the U.S. And generally, if the American economy is doing well, we're doing well as well. Another thing, actually, is I do remember we did benefit in the early years of the Trump administration from their super restrictive and ambiguous visa rules. So he started putting in these weird border restrictions. And I think that was particularly difficult on tech workers. Like the really screwed up one was if you were born in Iran or something, that was sort of hampering your ability to get into the United States, even if you, you know, given up your citizenship, which, you know, Iran doesn't really give up your citizenship if you call them and say, like, hey, screw you, Islamic Republic, I'm not an Iranian anymore. You know, they don't process that paperwork. So I did remember talking to some tech workers at the time who said, I can't, what am I going to do? I can't work in the U.S. if, you know, there's going to be some crazy executive order where I'm just waiting in a waiting room somewhere. So I think there was a bit of uptick from our tech sector, particularly the Victoria tech sector, where there was so much uncertainty around who you can bring in to work for you. You just bring that person into the tech sector that's closest to the States, Victoria. So I don't have any hard numbers on that, but yeah, if, you know, when the Americans screw up on things where we can sort of supplement our own talents, that's a good thing. But I'd say the biggest effect is don't attack Tory's car. Tory Marlin, who works for us, is recently moved here from the United States. And yeah, she already has, for a number of reasons, you know, she wants to get a BC license plate. You can't just show up, and it takes a lot of paperwork to get there. So it still says Washington State on it. So she already has the sign, like, you know, please don't attack my car. So, you know, doubly, no matter who wins, please don't attack her car.
Yes, that's it. And not just Tory, any numbered, plated out car there from the States, because there's still plenty around there with the signs on it saying I'm Canadian or things like that, with I've noticed.
Yeah, which is, that's not great for us. I'm thinking of after 9/11, when you had all these like Muslim-owned businesses saying like, hey, we denounce terrorism, or, you know, we support the U.S. or you shouldn't have to do that. We shouldn't assume that you're down with the 9/11 terrorists. Similarly, we shouldn't have to assume, hey, there's a Washington State plate. They're all, you know, they're probably all 100% MAGA or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, there's 350 million Americans. There's a wide variety of opinions in that country.
Which, I mean, mentioning even things like that being, you know, slightly humorous or not, I mean, how has that sentiment been by Canadians, Victorians, whichever way you want to look at it, on people in the States? Because one thing I've noticed since being here is that there seems to be a lot more negativity towards the US than has ever been when I've been in Canada before. And also speaking to people back home when it comes to traveling to this part of the world, a lot of people are turned off by going to the States now, and I'm not sure if that is a direct correlation to what the last 4 years have been or what's happening. I mean, are there numbers or statistics around tourism and things like that where, you know, maybe a Biden administration will see tourism numbers go back to the States compared to going over the border?
I think it's actually the opposite. I think we get a lot of traffic from blue states. So I think if we're just looking at a utilitarian standpoint, what's best for us? If we're looking for tourism, I think maybe you could see. So Trump wins, you're going to get a bunch of people in blue states who don't even want to, you know, so disgusted with the rest of the country, they don't want to go to any county that voted for Trump. So they come to us, you know, safe Canada just over the border. So, yeah, when the border opens, I think, you know, maybe we get more American tourists if Trump won versus Biden. I'm not sure. But in terms of us, Victoria, yeah, ever since I can remember, we had schoolyard games, like just hating the Americans for reasons we couldn't understand. I think it's just a tourist town. You find any tourist town and they always hate whoever the large major tourist source is. So I was able to get summer jobs every year as a result of the large proportion of American tourists who tipped me in American dollars that, you know, for some parts of my young career was like, you know, a 30 to 40% raise on top of the existing dollar. So all of my teenage expenditures, I paid my way through university as a result of Americans, but I still resent and hate them for some reason. you know, that's the way things go.
Sadly, I wish that was the same with New Zealand and Australia, but if somebody tipped me in New Zealand dollars, I end up having to take a loan to make it worth any money. So, you know.
Yeah, it's, you know, some kind of, you know, it looks like Monopoly money. So I there's probably some misconceptions. So even though they're so close, there's not as much travel between the island and the U.S. as you would think there would be. I do remember my sister, this was like the mid-1990s, they had pen pals in Seattle. So Seattle, the, you know, most liberal, safest, you know, tech city in the world. So they were going to take a bus tour down to Seattle and visit with their pen pal class. Just before they were about to leave, a bunch of parents said, "We can't let our children go to America. They're going to get shot. There'll be gun violence." So the trip was called off specifically because of that reason. Now, yeah, anybody familiar with the city of Seattle will understand that to be a somewhat hysterical belief as to the relative danger of Seattle. So, yeah, I think we hate Americans because we just see tourism and everybody hates tourists. And, you know, maybe there's just misconceptions about what it looks like. I enjoy my time in Washington State. You can get way better fireworks on July 1st than you can get here for Canada Day. July 4th, sorry.
And the Space Needle. I mean, come on. Who doesn't like the Space Needle, right?
Yeah, and the monorail.
Yeah, wow. Exactly. Pike Place.
Wonders galore.
Yeah, Macklemore sang about Pike Place, so it must be cool. So that's at least what I've been told. Mm-hmm. Well, it's an interesting thing in the States, of course, not only that their election is on a Tuesday of all days, but their elections essentially for everything are held on this one day. So for the president.
Yeah, I think this is the one thing that Canadians understand least about American elections.
Yeah.
And this is the most shocking and horrifying thing about the election I get. Because we hear about, you know, there's a presidential election. So we're used to our simple Canadian elections where, first of all, they're all broken up. So you vote for the provincial government different. At a time different from when you vote for the, you know, federal government and you vote for the municipal government. These are all separate elections. In the United States, they're all at the same freaking time. And they vote for a whole bunch of extra stuff that we don't even vote for. So like propositions and stuff. So, you know, when we had our proportional representation referendum, that was its own separate election. It didn't get crowded out by a federal or provincial election. So when you go to vote in the States, you get a booklet and you have to vote right at the top. It's you vote for president and then you vote for, you know, governor. So like state government, and then you're voting for senators, you're voting for Congress people. And then in some jurisdictions, because each jurisdiction is differently, you're voting all the way down to like university rectors, you know, school board trustees, and then there'll be a bunch of referendum proposition questions, basically referendum questions like, should we, you know, raise taxes 1% on this? So, you know, I'm sure a defender of the U.S. Republic style of democracy would say, well, that's good. More democracy. We're asking the citizens more questions. But I have no idea how anybody handles that, because you only have like 5 or 10 minutes to go into this huge booklet. And, you know, it's hard enough sort of making your decision at the presidential level. And you're supposed to have an informed choice on these dozens of other decisions. So I'm inclined to see it as a bad thing. I voted once in the Vancouver municipal election, and that was just a monstro ballot, just this huge ballot. And it's just thousands of names for each councillor. And you're like, there's, well, not thousands, but it was dozens of names. There's no way I'm going to possibly know. So you just try and vote along party lines or something. So I think that's what Americans do. Just I'm voting straight ticket Democrats. So, you know, if there's a sick cat running for, you know, the Democratic position for local school trustee, you just end up voting for them because you have no idea who this person is.
Which it's interesting you say that, because I know in Australia, for example, with a lot of our elections, it comes down to, you know, you're voting for the upper house, the lower house, but you will often have the option to either number all the boxes for each candidate, or just as long as you put a one in, like say for the lower house, and for the upper house, as long as you put in a one in the party, and then it will distribute your votes everywhere. I always have the fun part of it, though, Tristan, where I think one year we had about 55 candidates for the upper house in Tasmania for the federal election. And you also have the option, if you want to number them 1 to 55. So me loving elections and me loving voting, I stood there in that voting booth for a long time and voted 1 to 55. So I enjoy that sometimes. So I might enjoy the US elections that way.
Yeah, maybe. I'm of the mind that elections need to be simple. And I think when you look at, I mentioned the proportional representation referendum, I think it failed in large part because British Columbians didn't like the idea of a voting system that was going to be more complicated. So say what you will about first past the post, it is super easy.
Yeah.
You're voting in your riding. Here's four people who want to represent you in your riding. If you go up, you know, if you go to this street, it's going to be a different riding. It's based on who you vote for, and you just have to pick the one person, and then they figure out the whole party and prime minister thing at the legislative level. So whatever the system was going to be under proportional representation, it was going to be more complicated. Some of them are going to be super complicated. Some of the options were, you know, a little Byzantine. So I think voting has to be a balance of asking the people what to do and also making it easy and accessible. Because can you imagine if we had the Swiss system where they just ask us everything and I'm supposed to be making foreign policy decisions and tax decisions? I'm just not going to know. That's why you have representative democracy. You know, you're a professional. You're supposed to figure it out. And if you screw it up, I'd fire you and we get someone else.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know Tasmania has a system called the Hare Clark system in place for our state elections, which often confuses the hell out of most people. So I'm not sure if it's quite up there with the Swiss one, but if you ever want a quiet reading on a Monday night or a Tuesday night, Tristan, look up the Hare Clark electoral system in Tasmania.
And they voted judges in the states.
That is true.
Not every jurisdiction, but... they have their reasons. You know, it is technically more democratic, but that seems very strange to me as a Canadian, that you would have a judge actually campaigning, because, you know, obviously there would be some political interference in the decisions that judge would make versus an appointee. But anyway, we have to trust that a bunch of Americans are going to go in and get this giant phone book of decisions, and they're going to make the right decision. But I have great faith in masses of people to make the right decision in the long run.
Well, on that note, Tristan, before I let you go, speaking of all things uniquely American, one thing I always find entertaining about not only the election in the US, but pretty much anything American, they go all out. They make it almost very entertaining when it comes to things like this. And no question about their election coverage. Generally, whatever channel you watch, there's some entertainment factor. Are you going to prop yourself on the couch tonight and flick on the tube and kind of just watch all this play out?
No. No, I will not. No, I skip the debates. I skip, you know, it's not my country. So I'm going to get some cleaning done. I've got some mildew in the shower to take care of. That, so while everybody else is wasting your time on elections, I'm going to get some productive work done.
Okay. Well, you can make a big deal out of cleaning the mildew, perhaps, in the, you know, broadcast or do some commentary, get some, you know, an analyst in to...
No, I'm a private person.
You're a private, okay, right. Yeah. Well, if you ever change your mind, there's an option there. Tristan, always a pleasure to get you on the Capital Daily podcast. Thanks very much for your time today.
All right, thank you.
Coming up, all the day's news, plus find out how one person's Halloween decorations led to multiple police visits. Next. Local Matisse artist Lindsay LeBlanc has released a new series of original large and small format pieces at Moshqua Art and Soap Studio. This abstract series is inspired by the vibrant colours of the West Coast. Also available are traditional beadwork and vegan soaps. To see the releases and to check out her extensive range, head to moshqua.com. To the day's news now, and holding a 30-person Halloween house party has netted one Saanich resident a $2,300 fine. Saanich police told Check that the partygoers at the fined home were uncooperative, although police broke up several other 20 to 100-person Halloween gatherings without incident. This is the first ticket handed out in Saanich under the Quarantine Act. In August, Victoria Police similarly gave a $2,300 ticket to the host of an apartment party on Fort Street. Current provincial restrictions limit indoor gatherings to one household plus six others, and outdoor gatherings to 50 people, provided they are physically distanced. Vancouver's Granville Street made headlines over the weekend as hundreds of partiers were seen together crowding the popular strip. Darren Gowan, who directed his high school classmates to kill his mother and grandmother in 1990, has been denied his request at temporary unescorted absences from a Quebec minimum security jail. The Times columnist reported that the parole board found that Gowan remained a moderate risk to reoffend, despite several successful escorted absences and improvement in the management of his anger and narcissistic personality disorder. In 2017, Gowan, then known as Darren Huweneman, was denied his first chance at parole. The former peers he hired to go to Swanson and commit the inheritance money murders, Derek Lord and David Muir, are currently on day parole and full parole, respectively. In 1990, the pair stabbed and bludgeoned to death Sharon Hoeneman, 47, and her mother, Doris Leatherbarrow, 69, in the kitchen of Leatherbarrow's home. And the Rain Coast Conservation Foundation has purchased 530,000 hectares of hunting rights in the Great Bear Rainforest as part of an effort to prevent hunting of coastal carnivores. The $650,000 purchase of the Kitlope hunting tenure makes the foundation the official guide outfitter for the area, meaning they now hold the sole commercial rights to guide non-resident hunters, although BC residents can still hunt there. The previous license holder, Angus Morrison, had offered to sell the guiding rights to Raincoast and told the Narwhal that he was no longer comfortable hunting the region's animals and wanted to guide viewing tours instead. The foundation will hold trips as required by the BC Wildlife Act, but those will function instead as de facto sightseeing trips. The fundraiser was pushed across the finish line last week by international donations brought in by a video on the region's wolves, shot by National Geographic photographers Paul Nicklin and Christina Mittermeier. Before we go today, I wanted to leave you with an interesting story coming out of Texas, in which a man had several visits by the police after his very gory and graphic Halloween decorations were put out. According to the Toronto Sun, Stephen Novak's East Dallas property was converted into a haunted home with bloody, butchered dummies decorating his roof, front stoop, sidewalk, and lawn. Novak said he was against a hokey Halloween display featuring cliched ghosts and ghouls and wanted to go all out for it this year, adding the inspiration for it came with him wanting to make the scene hyper-realistic. To that, he whipped up some dummies and slung 20 gallons of blood all over, which has since made him good friends with the Dallas Police Department, claiming that cops have stopped by multiple times since the gory scene was erected. Now, looking at the picture, it's pretty easy to see why, as it does look quite realistic, although I have to applaud Novak doing something a little bit different, making something a little bit unique, and again, as he said, not to just go out for the standard ghosts and ghouls and things like that. So I do believe Mr. Novak has a definite leg up over everyone else out there for future decoration ideas. And that's it today for the Capital Daily Podcast for Tuesday, November 3rd, 2020. Big congratulations to Bea Prowse for their winning photo in last week's Capital Daily Photo Competition. The theme last week, of course, was Halloween, and Bea Prowse sent in an awesome photo of a ghost train at Duncan, which certainly went down well here at the Capital Daily office. Congratulations go out to Bea Prowse once again. And if you want to enter this week, hear more through the ads at the beginning or the end of this episode, or check out Monday's Capital Daily newsletter for all the deets. My name is Ben Waterworth, and as they say in Australia, bring on the state of origin. Thanks for tuning in, and I will speak to you tomorrow. Today's edition of the Capital Daily Podcast is brought to you by Moshqua Art and Soap Studio. To see the latest release of original large and small pieces, head to moshqua.com. Introducing the Capital Daily's Weekly Photo Challenge. Each week, our team will post the weekly photo theme in Monday's Capital Daily newsletter, as well as announcing it right here on the podcast, with winners receiving gift cards to local Victoria businesses around town. This week's theme is nighttime photography. To find out how you can enter, check out Monday's Capital Daily newsletter.